All right, we are going to get started. We had a powerful time in conference. That was fantastic. And then we are sending out another two of our own from here, because discipleship is the engine of the church. That is what drives it. And our vision, my passion in what I want to see is I want to see more of the men who are here to achieve their destiny. And so we're seeing that God's helping us. So as always, I'll probably do a lesson in the next few weeks. But as always, the issue is, after conference, what do you do with the calling in your life? And I'm urging you to press in. And we'll talk about some areas of that. So we're very privileged. We have a conference, always have people come from overseas. And I have asked Sergei Pakhovsky if he will give us a word this morning. And you take advantage. You can ask discipleship questions and questions that may arise out of his lesson. But Sergei is going to bring the word today. Go ahead.
I would like to tell you that the best thing that we can learn as disciples while we are still in the mother church is we need to learn to learn.
You'll have to speak up so they can hear you. No microphone.
This means that God is going to teach us all our lives, and it is impossible to learn everything while we are in the mother church. But we can learn to be teachable, correctable. We need to learn to accept what God is teaching us through other people. And this involves the willingness to learn. Willingness to learn is like muscles. It can be developed, and we must develop this ability in ourselves, because I believe that there are many keys to what it means to be a disciple. There are many characteristics of what involves discipleship, but the key characteristic is the willingness to learn. I can just put you a couple of examples that Bible scholars are saying that, for example, Apostle Peter, he drew his first epistle using excellent, from the grammatical point of view, excellent Greek, which means that there was another disciple, Greek disciple, who was writing this epistle for him. But the second Peter was written using Greek, which was not so perfect, which means that he learned Greek and then was able to learn how to write letters to them. I'm saying that in the willingness to learn, to expand his own ability to minister for people, he was constantly looking for something else to learn to be able to be used by God in a broader perspective. I can also put you an example of Apostle Paul. At the last moments or months of his life, he is writing in 2 Timothy 4:13, asking Timothy to bring him books, especially the leather cover. Can you imagine the guy? He was in jail, he was dying, he knew exactly that he was going to be beheaded or slaughtered, and he was still willing to learn. He was still willing to read books, write sermons, write epistles. He didn't know, he didn't have a clue how many days or months or years he was to live, and he was, to his last days, he was willing to learn. If you can ask me about things about that we learn in the ministry, I believe that a person who goes out to pioneer, he needs to be open to how God is going to lead this person, because I have pioneered 4 times in my life, twice in Russia and twice in other countries, and every time I can tell you, frankly, it was different experience. There are literally no formulas, because every city within one country is a different planet, different people, different mentalities. And if you have traveled about United States, for example, you must have noticed that. That's why it's so important to learn. And one of the best ways that I am finding that Jesus was teaching us, showing us to learn, we have in Russia this saying about a special learning method. This method is called try, fail, and try again method. It's a very nice method, and maybe I can ask somebody to read John chapter 1, verses 28 down to 41. There is a very interesting passage of scriptures over here, which helps us to see lots of things about how a church is being started. Maybe somebody can help and read. 1 John 1, 28 down to 41. If somebody can help me to read it quickly. Yes. Yes.
This all happened at Bethany on the other side of the Jordan where John was baptized. The next day, John saw Jesus coming toward him and said, "Look, the Lamb of God who takes away the sin of the world. This is the one who..."
Yes, keep reading.
"This is the one I meant when I said, a man who comes after me has surpassed me because he was before me. I myself did not know him, but the reason I came baptizing with water was that he might be revealed to Israel. Then John gave a testimony. I saw the Spirit come down from heaven and the dove and remain on him. I would not have known him except that the one who sent me to baptize with water told me, the man on whom you see the Spirit come down and remain is he who will baptize with the Holy Spirit. I have seen and I testify that this is the Son of God. The next day, John was there again with two of his disciples. When he saw Jesus passing by, he said, 'Look, the Lamb of God.' When the two disciples heard him say this, they followed Jesus. Turning around, Jesus saw them following him and asked, 'What do you want?' They said, 'Rabbi, where are you staying?' He said, 'Come, and you will see.' So they went and saw where he was staying and spent that day with him. It was about the 10th hour. And Andrew, Simon Peter's brother, was one of the two who heard what John had said and who had followed Jesus. The first thing Andrew did was to find his brother Simon and tell him, 'We have found the Messiah, that is the Christ.'"
So if you analyze this passage of scriptures, you will find out that the first day when Jesus went to that place, there were multitudes of people there. He was baptized, but he found no disciples there. Bible is using another phrase. Next day, he got back. The Bible says nothing happened. And then we find another one mentioned the phrase, next day, another time. He would come and return, and he was willing to look for people, and it was a place where there were lots of people, and first day nothing happened, which means he failed. So we got back next day, he failed again, nothing happened, didn't find anybody. Third day he found them. This is an incredible method that we need to be willing to keep learning, keep trying. If we fail, we just keep trying again. This is a great method by itself. And Bible is showing us that then one guy brings him to another guy brings him to third guy, Philip. Philip brings him to Nathanael, and this is how a church is started. We need to learn to believe God when nothing is happening. So many things are involved, but I want to focus our and all of your attention on the main principle from my perspective, from my point of view, which proves to God and proves to us and proves to pastor who is looking for a discipleable, teachable person that we are willing to learn. This is one of the most difficult things in discipleship from my perspective, is the art to ask questions. So as pastors, all pastors are looking for the person willing to learn, and the willingness to learn is confirmed by the art to ask questions. Mark 9:30, 31, 32, I will read to you fast, says an interesting thing. "For he taught his disciples and said to them, 'The Son of Man is delivered into the hands of men, and they shall kill him, and after that he is killed, he shall rise the third day.' But they understood not that saying, and were afraid to ask him." Bible repeats the same passage of scriptures in Luke 9:41 and down to 45. We can ask many other. We can find many other places in the Bible when Jesus would be teaching them, and they would just refuse to ask questions. The crucial issue about it came down to the Garden of Olives, and we know that they were all scattered and they betrayed him, because they, for many months and probably a couple of years, they would refuse to ask him questions about the crucifixion and everything that he had been trying for a long time to teach them. And they would learn lots of stuff, but this thing they failed. And Bible is showing us that the key issue was that they were afraid to ask questions. So I will ask you a question. Why people are afraid to ask questions?
Because
What do you think? Why do you think it's that? Yes.
Pride.
Pride. Why?
Pride some kids that they're wrong. They might look foolish.
Somebody else will start mocking them. I don't know, laughing at them. Okay, I agree. Maybe there is some other reason. Yes.
Because you don't want people to know that you don't know something.
Oh, it's pride from the other side, another angle of the pride, exactly. So it's like I know all attitude. I know all attitudes, so I don't want people to know that I don't know something. Okay, maybe there are some other reasons. Yes. Okay, that's a nice one. That was a nice one. Fear of rejection. Why? Pastor, we say that was a stupid question. I don't want to spend time answering this question. Oh, why? Why rejection? I agree, but why rejection? Okay. I'm asking you questions, right? Yes.
Maybe because they know what the answer is going to be and they don't want to deal with it. Maybe if it's they have to change or they don't want to lose Jesus or something.
This is
like
a very powerful statement, because sometimes people don't ask questions because they don't like the answer that they are assuming that they will. Sometimes they know the answer and they just don't want to accept it. There are all kinds of issues involved in that. But I want to show you a couple of things about asking questions, and I want to speak about how to ask good questions. Asking questions is not hard. Asking right questions is difficult. These are two different things. There is a classical passage of scripture in Matthew 7, verses 6 down to 8. If somebody might read it to us, maybe some of the things that you will remember out of this passage will help you, because this is classical problem in pastoring. Many people who failed to learn this thing in their mother church when they start pastoring, when they go into ministry, they learn by the hard lesson. Matthew 7, 6 down to 8. Maybe somebody will read it. Yes, please.
Do not give what is holy to the dogs, nor cast your pearls before swine, lest they trample them under their feet and turn and tear you in pieces. Ask and it will be given to you. Seek and you will find. Knock and it will be opened to you. For everyone who asks receives, and he who seeks finds, and to him who knocks it will be opened.
It is very interesting that Jesus was teaching his disciples not to help people who are not asking for help. In pastoring it is crucial. If a person is not ready or is not mature enough in his soul, in his attitude, in his mind, to form up or make up a question, usually this person is not ready to receive the answer. And Jesus is saying you can throw lots of pearls, precious truths and answers and principles, and try to teach this person and help this guy, help this couple, but if they are not asking for it, they are not ready to value that. For them, it's going to be just, the attitude, dog attitude. You know what the dog attitude? Barking and complaining, and you will be blamed later on. He says, they will dance upon these truths and of pearls that you are going to throw in front of them, and later on, they will blame you. They will try to tear you apart. So this is one of the key things which is related in the context of asking, if you have noticed. That's why I want to tell you that to make the right question, it's an art. It involves a lot of work, and I just want to give you a couple of steps, and maybe this will help some of you. I have learned all these things, and I'm still learning, but I have learned all of these things by the hard way. When I was sent out, when I was 18, it was 17 years ago, and I had lots of problems, because 18 itself, 18 years old, is an age when people have a view of life that they know everything. When I grew a little bit, I knew that there were lots of things that my view of life changed a lot, but I had to learn all these things by the hard way. So maybe some of you will be able to save up some years of your life if you are making if you're paying attention and making notes. The classical problem of discipleship that people, when they enter the ministry and become pastors, many of them, they fail to understand that we will never stop being disciples, and they stop being disciples when they are sent out. And many times when something is not happening in their ministry or in their church, they will ask this classical question to their pastor. They will call their pastor and ask him, why is my church not growing? Nobody in the world is able to answer you this question. Because very often people have a bad attitude when they ask questions about their problems, because they are not willing to do the analytical work, to come up with the right question. And all they do, they are just trying to push their personal responsibility on someone else, in this case pastor, just to secure themselves from any kind of failure in future, and to be able to call pastor later on and say, I've done everything you told me, and this is your fault that it failed again. So this kind of attitude makes all kinds of wise pastors not answer questions of this kind. What do I do? Why is my church not growing? Nobody will be answering your question. If we are talking about, for example, overseas missionary churches, can you imagine my pastor is in Russia, he's in Vologda. I am, for example, in Cuba, in Havana, and I'm calling him and asking him, what do I do? How in the world can he know what I should do, because he has never been to Havana, Cuba. He has no understanding about what's going on in that society. How can I ask him this general question and expect this incredible, supernatural, full of wisdom, you know, answer? It's impossible. He will answer me the classical answer of all pastors, and this is not an escape from the trap of bad attitudes when the wrong questions are asked. This is the wisdom. The general answer of the pastor is pray and ask God, which is translated into understandable English is, I don't know, you must find God and God will tell you what to do. But if you really want wisdom, you need to learn to ask right questions. And it involves, from my perspective, it involves seven different steps. So if you're ready, I can give you a couple of them, okay? So first of all, you need to know what you want to be happening, what you want. You need to see the goal, the purpose, what you want to see in your ministry, in your church, in your people, let me put it this way, what you want to see happening. If nothing is happening, for example, You need to know what you want to see happening. This is the first thing. You need to know what you need to know what you want. Second thing, you need to see what you have. This means that you need to think about the situation, and you need to really pay attention to what's going on, what's happening, what is there or what is there not. The third thing, you need to see the difference, what you want and what is there or there not, because if you are not able to compare and see the difference, you're just complaining about life, just complaining about difficulty of ministry, you're just backing up. If you are not able to see the difference between what you want to be happening or to see that that has to be happening and what is there. Because without that, you won't ever be able to see the problem. Then you need to, number four, you need to analyze the reasons why something is happening or the other way that you want it, or why something is not happening the way you want it. You need to make an analysis. And you need to come up with some key points or reasons why things are happening the way they're happening or not happening, how you wish them to be happening. Number five, on this stage, you need to start asking yourself questions. What can be my role in the situation? What can I do to change the situation? Some details. You need to come up with some details. What can you do? Your personal role. To do that, you need to ask yourself questions. What you have done to change, what can be done, what you have not done, yet have not done. Number six, when you have done it all, this is a great point when you start praying and asking God, looking for His direction. What else you can do? And then when you're analyzing all these previous stages, you need to, while you are praying and asking God what you can do to change the situation, you need to come up with a plan. I know that we have enjoyed this incredible conference video, which is called Plan A, but I usually have Plan A, Plan B, sometimes C. Never more. Because only a genius can have six plans, detailed, you know, and well organized, but I'm not a genius and I cannot come up with seven or six plans. When I was 18, I had six plans how to bring the church people, the church congregation from the city where I was pioneering to the conference, to Vologda, and it was a difficult time, 90s in Russia, economical problems, nothing is functioning the way it's supposed to function. So I came up with six plans, plan A, B, C, D, E, F. All of them failed. And plan number seven worked. It was plan number eight in the church of some other pastor. I called him and we just used his transportation. And I was very ashamed in my pastor. Pastor Golubev has been reminding me this situation, this story for many, many years. So I'm hoping I have learned something. Many plans, they are... they can be a danger, they can cause organizational chaos. And when we do that, the people or disciples in our churches that follow us, they can learn on our example to have plan A, B, C, D, E, F, means that they will learn only to react to problems, to solve problems, but it can be translated with some other phrase. Create chaos around themselves or create problems. That's what they can learn. We need to show them that we are able to be organized, well organized. Plan A, B usually is enough. It is stupid not to have plan B. Because life is life and devil exists. So you have plan A, B, C. Maximum. Okay? So six points. Step number seven. Is you calling your pastor. You have done a lot of work before you call your pastor. And you call your pastor and you are trying to draw with your own words the situation. You're explaining to him briefly what's going on, what you want to be going on, what's not going on. Then you give him your personal analysis of the situation, why things are the way they are, why something is not going on the way you'd like to see it going. And then you are telling him the reasons from your perspective. You have done an analysis. You are explaining to him your perspective, what's your thinking. Then you are telling him your plan, what you are going to do to change the situation. This is very important. And after you have done it all, you can ask the question, final question, what else, Pastor, do you think I can do? Or, where have I made a mistake in the analysis of the situation? You're assuming, supposing, maybe I have not seen something. Maybe there is something else. Maybe there are other reasons. From your perspective, from your experience, Pastor, what else would you advise me to do? And when you do it this way, I can guarantee you will receive a totally different answer from your pastor. And this will be some really guiding answers. I have done it many, many years this way, and Pastor Golubev has been able to always give me some direction. Because he is able to see the situation with your eyes, he is able to see something else that you cannot see, and I don't know why it happens, that's why we need discipleship. He is always able to show me something that I have not seen. And so the problem with many people is that they don't know how to make right questions, because the attitude, as I have told you before, that people are not willing to put off their pride And most often, the attitude of people is that they are willing to push their personal responsibility for the situation, for ministry, for church, for whatever, on someone else. To be able to blame somebody else. To pretend that they've been submitted. Yes, I followed your advice. I followed your advice, Pastor. And this couple, we love them. They left the church, you know. Whatever. You know what I mean? You are not excluding your personal responsibility. And in this way, asking questions by this way will really teach us all kinds of things. And the best of all, that this way of asking questions will keep us humble, will keep us in the right attitude of heart, and will keep us being disciples of our pastors once we've been launched out, and 100 years after we have been launched out. This will always remind us that we will always need our pastor. And this spirit, this right spirit, will be like fingerprints upon the attitudes of your disciples and people that will follow you, and they will do the same. And you will succeed in your ministry. That's all I have prepared for you. If you have any questions. Questions? Yes.
Okay, so I'm... Because we've learned to ask our pastor stuff. So what you're saying is don't just go and try to have him solve the problem for you without you working out anything.
Yes.
Go to him after thinking of it, not like after days and days of, you know, all this stuff, but
exactly.
Think about it, analyze
exactly.
It, and say, you know, go to him with some kind of background story, what I would do, and give it to
him
like
be
that.
Brief. It must be brief. It must be key things.
Okay.
Because, you know, you cannot tell him for 40 minutes or 1 hour what's going on.
Yeah,
I mean,
okay.
Nobody has this time.
Okay.
Yes, exactly.
But don't just go to him and have him solve it without you working on it.
If the situation is so simple that you don't need all this analytical work, you can solve it yourself. If it's not, you need to make this analytical analysis and you need to look for some guidance. That's what I think. Maybe 10 years from now I will change this discipleship class and add something else, some other points, but that's all that I have for now. I don't know if you guys have any other questions. Yes, please.
When I heard you talk about this list and stuff, it's kind of like a marriage. You're married to the church. Because I look at it and it's like, you know, my relationship with my wife, like, we have these struggles and we have these things that we got to work through. Like, because, you know, like pushing the blame, like I hear that, like me and my wife at times, we push the blame on, like, why I'm acting the way I am is because of the way she's acting the way she is. So, I mean, like, if we look at the church, like we look at our marriage, I mean, we might be able to do this, right? I mean, this checklist kind of reminded me of, like, what I have to do in my marriage.
Yeah, maybe. Why not? Why not? I have a story of a very good friend of mine. He's a very good pastor with great success in his ministry. And he was telling me and some other pastors that when he got married, his wife picked up all the suitcases and left the house and went to the house of her mother 3 weeks after the wedding. So then she would come back. You know, they try to, you know, sort out the situation and everything. And then she would leave another time. When she left the third time, he started asking questions. Maybe I'm doing something wrong. So sometimes it takes time for us to see the problem, that the problem can be enough. I don't know. It's true. It's true. It's true about probably every one of us. Most of the time, we are not able to admit that the problem can be in us. That's why we need to learn to ask questions with an open heart, because most of the time God can show us our role in the situation, what we are doing in the wrong way, or what we are not doing that we should be doing that would have changed the situation. So most of the time the answer of my pastor would be myself changing the direction of my actions, my attitudes, or something else. So that's why you're all right. The reason why people don't ask questions is their pride. They don't want, not willing, they are not willing to receive the answer. Teachable spirit. Disciple means discipleable person, teachable, correctable. That's the key. If a person is not teachable, it's not a disciple, he can never be discipled, he will never be able to be used by God. He can have most of the talents of most of the people in church. It's impossible to build anything, or God cannot use this person. We need to be humbled. Yeah. All our lives. All our lives. Any other questions? I'm hoping that this stuff is helping someone over here. Yes, please.
I'm thinking that the, you know, the old man is defeated, but he's not dead. And the seems to me that the nature of the old man is self-justification. And it rises up in us readily, you know, as a saved person, in justifying ourselves that we're doing the right thing and can't imagine what the problem is, rather than really look at ourselves honestly. That's the most difficult thing. And see what we've done wrong or have omitted, or, you know, where the problem lies. But it's easy to justify and therefore not ask those questions and, you know, get the light of truth on us, on our hearts, to see where we are missing it.
Yes, I believe it. I believe it. It's true. The reason why most of you are not asking questions right now, because you have probably started analyzing. I'm hoping for that. It really is a result of a lot of work before someone comes up with the right question. So I hope you will put that to practice. I don't know. Any more questions? Yes, please.
When someone asks you a question,
yep.
How do you tell their motive? Like, because sometimes people, like you said, they ask, they're sincere, they really want to know, and sometimes they ask a question because they don't want to know the answer. It's like a rhetorical question.
Oh, that's a classic question. A good one. The form, how people make up the question. Actually, you can learn much more about the person, his character, his personality and motives by the questions that a person makes, rather than by listening to what this person is saying. The questions are revealing the focus of the heart of the people. That's why I am paying a lot of attention to the questions. Jesus was provoking people for questions. You will find this technique that he was using. For example, he would preach using parables. No one in the world can immediately understand parables. You just need to turn brains, you know, you need to analyze, you need to start thinking. And Jesus was actually teaching his disciples to think. He was teaching them to ask questions. Jesus, who has sinned? He, this guy, or his parents? You know, they would always ask all kinds of questions. Or he would offer them questions that would lead them to asking other questions. For example, well, how are we going to feed these guys, you know, 5,000 people? And they're going to, oh, we need 200 denarius. Someone has come up with that. This means he has done some calculation, right? It's been work. You know, they were trying to, he was pushing them to do that. Oh, Jesus, you know, these tax collectors, they're saying that the church needs money. Are you willing to give money? Jesus answers by another question. Do I have to give money? You know what I mean? He was teaching them using all kinds of questions. He knew it would be very, very helpful for them. So by the form that a person asks a question, you can know if his attitude is right or wrong. You just need to pay attention to the way how that person asks. Sometimes you look into the eye of this person and you know. It's not so difficult. Yes, please.
In asking questions like about the Bible, is there a way that you found in asking, or just ask whatever, is it along the same lines of you're thinking about it, you're praying about it, you're trying to see God, and if you come to the point where you really don't understand, is that when you ask?
Yes, I believe it. I believe it. Because very often when you pray, God will show you on another page the answer, or in the context of what you're reading. When I was starting churches, I was provoking people, new people, to ask questions about the Bible. I was more interested in their questions about the Bible than in their questions about life. Because when they start read the Bible, they start analyzing their lives, and they're starting seeing the application to their lives. This was my key every time. because I don't want to be Mr. Hezo the question answers guy, you know. I don't want to be guru for those people, you know what I mean? We are teaching them to have relations with God. We are teaching the people to find directions through their Bible, through their relations with God. If they are not taught, sometimes you know the answer. Sometimes people come up to you and you know the answer. And if you're foolish, you can just give them this answer. And sometimes you just need to be wise and say, well, you can pray and ask God, you know. This is a good question. I will ask God as well, you know. And very often people are going to find the answer. Another rule that I personally have, I never give counseling to people before the sermon is preached. After the sermon is preached, most often people receive their answer. I don't want to be answering their questions. I don't want to play God in their lives. You know what I mean? Because when they receive the answer from God, it's another thing, another dimension, another conviction. It's not just this guy in a tie who gave me what to do. You know what I mean? In Russia, it's a big problem, for example, because people have been taught for centuries that somebody thinks for them. And this is bad. We want to teach people to think. God is developing people. He's teaching them to think, to analyze, to see their role, to see the reason, to see what they can do, how they can take an initiative to change something. That's why all the societies that have experienced the biblical revival, these societies have grown and have been developed. Christianity gives development. Third world countries are usually countries with witchcraft, idolatry, guru mentality. Somebody thinks of that. That's what I think. Yes, please.
You said you don't want to be a guru, and so I mean, should we not try to answer every question? I mean, when people come, when you're pioneering, they're going to have all sorts of questions. I mean, we're not going to be able to give
sometimes them. Yes, sometimes no, and you pray and you ask God. In every situation is different. That's why I'm praying to be sensitive to God, to the Holy Spirit. And sometimes I need to say yes and give them the answer. Sometimes I just know that this person needs to learn by experience, or he needs to pray. Most of the people, they view pastor, that pastor must give me the answer, because they are lazy, they don't want to read their Bible. They don't want to pray, they don't want any personal responsibility. And I've been trapped in this trap for many years, you know, and the church never grows, because people just don't, they just wouldn't take responsibility. They are very comfortable with having a pastor, who gives them the answer. And when pastor is not around, what happens? They are always going to be kids who need diapers, you know, somebody has to change them diapers and all the time diapers, and this church will never win the world, and we'll never have disciples, and we'll never grow. You know what I mean? This is important. We are teaching people to grow, take responsibility, and follow God, not just follow man. If I answer all the questions of people in church, I will be the key to that church. And when I leave, for example, if God calls me somewhere else, the church collapses. Or they hate the second pastor who comes because he is not this way. He is not answering their questions, and they're saying he doesn't love them. You know what I mean? We are teaching people to follow God, not us. Yes, please.
Before you went into Cuba or pastoring before, were there any questions you asked your pastor or that you wished you would have?
I don't remember. I don't remember. I have noticed one thing. For example, in Russia, I know many pastors. Pastors who have their churches growing are usually pastors who call Pastor Golubev and ask questions. Pastors who never ask questions, they don't have their churches growing. They can be stuck for years. And it's incredible. It's incredible for me. I have been calling Pastor Golubev more than any other time in my life when I was in Cuba, asking him questions the way that I have explained to you. And, you know, he was glad. He was glad I was calling. Because I remember a couple of times in different other churches in my past, when I would just stop communication with him for 2-3 months. You know, it looks freaky. You know, what's going on with this guy? Is he still alive? Why is he not calling, you know? I was not calling because I was having all kinds of answers, because I was going astray. So this is another sign for my pastor. The guy is not calling. So he started calling me, asking me careful questions. How are you, brother? You know what I mean? Are you still alive? My pastor would be calling me to jail, asking me in which state I was, if I was still alive. And I knew exactly what he was asking me. So this is good. Questions are really helpful.
What would be some examples between when you're ministering to Russians and the Cubans? You said how it's different in each place. Can you give a few practical examples of what would be a difference in how you approach the people or how they thought? Or
Russian people are not emotional people. They practically never smile. They never show you the emotional part of their life. Cubans are totally different. They're very extra, super mega emotional, and their emotions drive them. This was one of the biggest differences. Then I would have to see the difference in mentality. The mentality of, for example, Russian people are very indecisive. They have an incredible fear to make decisions because of the fear of failure. So they prefer to minimize the percentage or the possibility of a failure by not making any decisions. You don't make decisions, you probably don't have so many failures. It's just that all your life turns out to be a big failure. and in Cuba, the difference was that they were too impulsive, making decisions, stupid decisions, without even having thought about it. It's another thing. But from the mentality point of view, most of the things were absolutely equal, very much alike. Cubans are very much like Russians in many aspects. They have a saying, for example, that a Cuban mentality, a person in Cuba, if there is a goal, a Cuban or either comes close but never reaches the goal, or goes beyond but never reaches the goal. There is o no llega o se pasa in Spanish. And this is so Russian, because Russians are this way. So many things were alike and many things were different. Another thing that I found about Cubans and Russians, that in Russia men are usually more destroyed and damaged by sin than women. In Cuba it's different. Cuban women is a disaster. It's a national curse. They are much worse than men. I have never seen it in my life. I had always been thinking that the sin affects men more than women, but in Cuba it's different. Cuban women are predators. Point. Too serious.
So
this was the difference with Russia.
So then the practical outflow of that is what you're saying is if someone did not analyze and recognize that, if you came and insisted on approaching Cubans like Russians, then you would fail.
Exactly.
You would struggle. Okay.
Exactly.
Yeah. So that's a very good point. I'm asking that partly because I want to know, but also because that's true everywhere. That exact point is true in every city and in every culture that you're working with. That's very powerful. Very good.
In analyzing the differences between Russians and Cubans, do you need to find out why they're like that? Like, is it the national religion or just society? Do you need to find the root, or just find out that they're like this, we need to work?
This is a very, very good question. To find out why, I needed to read books, you know, and I came to start to understand why Cubans were this way only 3 years down the road.
Okay.
So I needed time and experience to do that. But when I just was able to find that they are this way, you just accept it, they are this way. And you are able to minister, to pray, and ask God, what do I do to help them?
So you didn't figure it out without...
Yeah, you don't need to figure out why. Many, many often people are asking God questions, why? But this is very often as the wrong question. Yes, you can find out why, but you're just being curious. This is not really the issue. The issue to see that they are this way and to ask God, what do I do to help them not to be this way, to change? Yes?
I know that anytime I'm surrounded by a lot of people who are angry, for instance, it's easy to get angry. When you're in a foreign culture, let's say you're dealing with, you know, what you mentioned in Cuba, emotionalism, or in Russia, indecisiveness, how do you keep the negative aspects of that culture from getting on you and from affecting the way that you act and affecting your personality when you're immersed in this other culture?
When Bible is telling us the story about Jesus who was getting out of boat with his disciples when this maniac from Gadara was approaching him, the first impression that we have that this guy doesn't want to know Jesus. He says, you have come to torture us, and then we read that these were the words of the demons, which means that in life, when how people react or what they say, their attitude, negative or aggressive attitude, very often is not what they have inside. People are wearing masks. I don't believe what people are saying. I believe that this can be devil lying to me. Most of people that I have come across in life, they are looking for answers. They are just looking in the wrong way, in the wrong place. Most people want to come to God. Many of them have just failed to find a person that might be able to explain them the gospel in a non-religious way. Explain them that God really wants to help them. So I just don't react when I see negative reaction. Most of people who react negatively, 1 month or 6 months later, they come and get saved. You know what I mean. Not most people, but very, very many people. They do like that. So you just filter these things. And in life, everything is not the way it seems or looks. You just believe God, and you know that people are people. You just appreciate them for what they are. Most people have aggressive attitude because aggressiveness is a sign of pain inside of their soul. Don't take it personal. It's not about you. It's about that something is really hurting on the inside. I'm saying from the experience, jail experience has helped me a lot to see that. People are aggressive there because they're insecure and they're afraid that somebody will find out that they're afraid of something. Just a mask. It's just a mask. Yes?
I really found it interesting what you said, how you recognize the two cultures. Paul writes to Timothy, Paul basically tells Timothy the Christians, the moral prophet say the Christians are still valiant and liars. And all that sort of proves what you're saying, that if you ask your pastor about the culture, Paul has an insight on what their prophets would be. You know, you say something. And I think for me personally, like asking questions is probably really wrong for me. It isn't right. Part of it is you have all these justifications, like, right? If I ask questions, I'll be wasting my pastor's time. You know what I mean? And it's pride, like, he's going to think I'm an idiot if I ask this question. You know what I mean? So that kind of stuff, so it's basically what's in that question.
I believe that this was a very good comment. And sometimes we can feel like idiots while asking questions, and sometimes it's true, we can be idiots. But I'd rather be an idiot for a minute while asking a question or than be an idiot all my life. You know what I mean? Without having asked one.
So we have, we've been taught that, you know, you go on a mission work, if you go overseas or whatever, even if you go pioneering, you have a limited amount of time. Did you do research into Cuba before you went there? Did you, what were some of the preparations that you made?
Yes, I would read articles, National Geographic, you know, or all kinds of other stuff and materials. But it all turned out to be false. It was just propaganda for tourists. Everything I read was lies. The best thing that I have not learned all the truth. I didn't know what to expect. That's why I was not afraid of anything, because I didn't know what to be afraid of. It really helped me to be positive And another thing, God was helping me to find right people and find some books. And when I was in Cuba on the black market, I was able to find a book. It was a doctorate thesis of a professor of Havana University, written 90 years ago. It was called, that book was called Mentality of Cuba. I was very much interested. When I read the book, I found out that it's not communism, it's not Fidel Castro, it's just in them. They were. It was like a newspaper from yesterday, you know, exactly about the way they are. And he was describing that they were always like that. And he was saying that about many things that helped me to come to understand why they were the way they were. 90 years later, and they are the same.
Very tough.
Some advice on how to make sure that you hear the answer, understand, and receive it correctly.
Maybe I didn't understand your question. What do you want to say about that?
How can you make sure that you get the most out of the answer?
I think I understand. The problem of human ears, Jesus was always referring to the way how people were hearing him, right? He who has ears, let him hear. This is an incredible revelation in itself. Most people have ears, but they are not listening. They are not hearing you. They are filtering you. Most of the time, you will have to repeat the answer. People will hear a portion of your answer, and they will come up with the same question later on. All the time. It happens all the time. Practically with anybody. You just need to be patient. If a person has heard one third from your answer, next time he will hear another third. Third time it will be, you know, last third. But if he keeps coming to you seven times, he's just a rebel. Don't waste your time. That's what I believe.
Classic. So seven thirds is bad.
Yeah, seven thirds obviously does work. Yes.
Well, so on what you said, there's people sometimes that are always coming for financial help, and after a while, it's like, you know, they're just wasting your money, and you don't want to invest any more finance. Are there people who are like that with constantly coming to you with dilemmas? I just don't know what to do. And I've had people in my life before where I really wanted to help them. I really love these people. But I can see that the real issue after a while, like, this person just feels sorry for themselves and they want something to complain to, or this person has just got a bad attitude. Is there a point where you tell somebody, I can't give you any more answers than I've already said?
I was telling to people sometimes, listen, I'm just a man. I cannot help you if you are not willing to make decisions. I would always like encourage people to make decisions. Have you done what I've told you before? You have asked me this question, for example. No? Well, why are you asking me the same thing? I cannot tell you nothing new. So sometimes I just shut people down with this way. Maybe it helps them, maybe not, but sometimes they need to hear that. Sometimes people need to go in their stubbornness and fail and be hurt before their heart is humbled. So I'm praying during this process as a pastor. I can see the process, and I know that the person is headed towards pain, and it's good. I'm just praying for this pain not to be a wreck of neck, you know, that the person can survive next time. Sometimes you just need to be patient. And he comes up to you, and you don't need to say, haven't I told you? Haven't, you know, it's not helping them. It's just humiliating them more. You just don't do that.
Is there an important part of analyzing or learning about a certain people you're describing, Cubans and Russians, how they respond differently? It seems like, you know, you'll find that everywhere. You know, people will be either emotional at the altar and you won't see them again, or they'll be, you know, like the Russian, you know, no emotion. Is there a part, though, that you are trying to find out what motivates them to serve God? Or
Yes, there are things that work for some people. For other people, there must be another thing. I found one interesting thing in Cuban culture. They don't have songs in minor tunes, only in major. But Russians, they prefer minor music. Do you know why? Because minor music in D minor, E minor, you know, A minor, it helps you to think and analyze life. Self-pity sometimes, but you know what I mean. But when you have only dancing music in major, salsa all the time, you cannot think analyzing life. So Cubans are not analyzing life. Music for them is a drug. To shut the brain, turn the brain off, and not to think. It was incredible for me, an incredible thing for me to find out. So I found a couple of songs for the song service that were in minor, and people were deeply moved immediately in Cuba. You know what I mean? I don't know how it works. I don't know the details, but you know what I mean? I could see that, and God showed me that. They were escaping time with themselves to analyze life. Always trying to put this dancing music to make everybody believe they are happy and everything is fine. Complexes, masks, escapes from conscience. Different things.
Especially with some of the interactions as far as having different governments and such, as you're working with people, oftentimes those questions can have two different sources of motivations, either to truly understand or to undermine, kind of like a little cadet, but why? But why? But why? And so, as a pastor, people come in and they've had the experience where they can't trust authority, and that's their basic premise in life, is that you have to question to protect yourself. As a pastor, you love these people, so you don't want to describe them off as rebels or anything like that. Can you describe the experiences you've had, or what you've gained as far as how to handle situations where they're not rebellious, it's just they naturally question.
That's a good question. In Cuba, people are immune to any kind of good news because they think it's propaganda all the time. So they do not believe whatever you're saying to them. They are filtering it and are trying to read between the lines. That's why this principle that I have explained to you has really helped me. I was not trying to run their lives because they are naturally were having expectations to see any position of authority, like a pastor, for example, as somebody who's trying to manipulate them. That's why if I could see any problems in them, I was not trying to give them answers immediately, was not trying to push them to make decisions, because they would immediately interpret that as manipulation. So, but I would preach to them the Bible. I would teach them to make right decisions, to believe and trust God, and make their own decisions. Sometimes it would take 6 months or 1 year for somebody. I know that the process is slow, but they would come to appreciate later on the experience or the result of their decisions that were their own decisions rather than yes sir, no sir. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So and I could see that this complex could be healed, and they were not seeing my position as a pastor or authority as someone abusive or manipulative, and they would change their perspective about authority. One of the things that I was very careful about is not to open up my mouth to say one little syllable against the government. I would never use no illustrations about Abraham Lincoln on the history of the United States, because, you know, all kinds of great illustrations. But I'm in Cuba, and people are paranoid. And I would lift up, the biblical teachings about praying for your government. We were praying for the government. One gentleman came up to me, 74-year-old, and asked me, can we pray for this dying Hugo Chavez? And I said, of course. And we prayed for Hugo Chavez. He died 1 week after, but it's another story. And I would teach them that Apostle Paul was always encouraging the churches, according to Romans 13, to pray for the government. And this means that he had been praying for years for Nero, the guy who finally killed him. It doesn't matter. Politics doesn't matter. We can preach the gospel. And I was teaching them to love their country, to be a blessing for their country, and this was so revolutionary for them, because that was the first time they would hear that. All the churches in Cuba are messing with politics. That's why Cuban government, the moment it hears about some missionary or somebody, they immediately think a spy from another country trying to put a flag into the hearts, flag of influence into the hearts of our people, and they will start to oppose you immediately. And since I was not doing that, and for years they were helping us, they were allowing us to do things. It was because we were very transparent and we were preaching good things and encouraging people to love their country. I had a meeting with a deputy from the National Assembly of Cuba, an ex-pastor of some Baptist church, and he would tell me that that was so incredibly different in us and in our church, that all the churches in Cuba are preaching against the government rather than preaching against the sin.
Yeah.
Big difference. And that's why they allowed me to stay there for so many years.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why they didn't kick me out of country during the first 2 months. Authority.
Praise God. That's very powerful. Okay, we're going to stop there. That was a great blessing. That was a wealth of wisdom. Let's give him a good hand. And all right, that's all we have. God bless you.